Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm well. I'm well indeed. I actually... I was very interested to read about something that happened to a chef that falls in the... I'm always interested in stories that are the sort of blessing and a curse stories.
Yes.
I have two sides of it.
We did recently read about one that was both a blessing and a curse, something that happened to a restaurant.
Oprah's personal chef, Art Smith, has opened a new Southern Comfort restaurant on the Gold Coast. You know, you're Oprah's personal chef. I bet that's a pretty good salary. I bet he makes more than we do. Anyway, so now he opens a restaurant.
But more importantly, he opens a restaurant, and, you know, obviously he's got some notoriety. So the restaurant does a fair amount of business just because of his notoriety.
So he's doing great, right? Mm-hmm. Well, turns out that last Tuesday he was on Oprah's show. Oprah had him on, and she's crazy about his cooking, right? Guess what happens when you go on Oprah? Okay, they put in 3 extra reservation lines.
Okay.
They're swamped.
Let me help you with something. If Oprah mentions your book at her book club, you sell 1 million to 2 million copies of your book.
Yeah, but the work to sell them is done by clerks across the country.
And that's great because it's a book, and what you do is you print more books. Okay, if you have a 50, 60, 70, 100-seat restaurant... You can't print more chairs.
Yeah. Well, and okay? you can't get more phones.
You can't get more phones. You can't all of a sudden have 70 people in your office answering the phone
to tell them that you're full.
And you know, so what's happened is there are all kinds of people saying, "Oh, the service at this restaurant is terrible. They don't answer their phone. That when they do answer their phone, they're in a hurry. They're you know, and so they're getting all this negative press in the blogosphere out there, which is the people out there writing on their own little home pages. And come on, he was on Oprah.
Yeah, well, the funny
a million thing. People saw it. 10, 20, 50 million people saw the restaurant. A lot of people are calling all at once. There's no possible way that any freestanding, standalone business could not suffer.
Well, yeah, I mean, he doesn't have a call center staffed with 25 operators,
right.
You know?
He's not Bank of America,
he's
you
got,
know.
You know, he had 3 phone lines. He had a phone line and 2 spillover lines, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put in 3 extra phone lines. But it's, you know, Oprah mentions you. Mm-hmm. That's you're an old economy business with
right.
an internet.
Right, yeah. You're brick and mortar.
So, but it's funny, here's one of the people who's writing bad things about him. This was on the Menu Pages blog. After seeing the new restaurant Oprah show, all I wanted to do was buy a gift certificate, and I got so much flack I don't even want it anymore. She couldn't get through on the phone. They didn't have a fax machine. And she writes, someone didn't think this problem through about accepting money orders. They probably didn't have it. Mm-hmm. Okay, they were probably a local restaurant.
Right, exactly.
You know, it's a Southern Comfort restaurant. You know what I mean? They were accepting cash only, probably. And then she writes, I always think that people like Art, who is wonderful and recommended by Oprah, has to live up to Oprah's standards. Okay, first of all, what are the Oprah dining standards? Why? Because, I mean, I think Oprah's great.
Yeah.
But what? Why are we like, oh, you're not as good as Oprah? I mean, what? Are there Oprah dining standards?
I'm sure that there are, but I don't know what they are.
I'm upset because all I did was want to buy my nephew a gift certificate for his birthday. You know, something special. Well, the girl on the phone took the nice out of my head. This was horrible customer service. Lady, they're overwhelmed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't think sometimes that people think things all the way through when you talk about customer service. And listen, it's a restaurant. Their job is customer service. And honestly, but what do you do? What do you do when you're a restaurant that's set up to take 40, 50, 100 phone calls a day, and now all of a sudden you take 40 or 50,000 phone calls.
Well, you can't. You don't take 40,000 or 50,000 if they wouldn't get through. So what happens is your phone lines are busy all the time.
They're busy all the time. Your answer machine is constantly full. There's not enough people to even return the messages on your answer machine. There's not enough people to answer the phone. There's not enough people to service the people that want to come. There's no way.
You know,
there's no way there could be in that type of a place.
The restaurant by the name is called Table 52. Give them a call. I'm not going to give out the number. But, you know, it's funny because you look at it and say, oh, yeah, well, we all should have such problems. And in a way, you know what?
Right, sure. I mean, and I'm sure that what will happen is as this kind of
fades,
furor fades down a little bit, the restaurant will find its niche. And one of the things will happen is it's ratcheting up and the press will ratchet down a little bit. And they'll find that happy medium where it all works. But
well, here's the problem in the meantime. Is when you get a big media hit like this, you can get a bad...
Mm-hmm.
You're gonna have bad things happen. So say this guy opens his restaurant. He's got some regular customers. They,
right.
you know, they like coming in. He's starting to build a local base. He gets mentioned on Oprah. Now listen, I'll take it. Okay, Oprah,
right.
talk about
absolutely.
Him, but what happens is then Oprah mentions him, and the phone is busy day and night. So his regular customers who are going there on a regular basis
just can't get through.
Can't get through. Now what do you do?
Can't get through. Can't get in.
And
stand outside on a 100-person line to the restaurant that they just walked into for the last year.
Well, so then what happens? You have a period of time where these people who would be regular customers who live in the neighborhood, who live in the town, that you just fall off their radar.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? A year or two from now, a year and a half from now, you know the Oprah residual from the one mention on her show is gone, and your local people don't have you. But I'm always amazed. Reservations are always a good idea, but we can usually get you in.
Sure.
Okay, because you know why? Because we started as a 50-seat restaurant in a space that we now fit 30 seats, next to three theaters in a restaurant in a town with, you know, quite a few fine dining restaurants, but not as many as today. And we had 50 seats, and we were very popular, as we remain, thank heaven, popular. But I now have two restaurants with 125 seats in each.
Mm-hmm.
I can usually get you in. You might have to wait a little bit if you don't have a reservation, but I can usually get you in. But back when it was 50 seats in one of the most popular restaurants in the state, we would turn people away all the time.
Sure.
And people would get mad at us occasionally.
Yeah, you know.
And I never understood that.
Yeah, there's 45 seats here. There are people reserved for it. How can – and I never – again, that's perspective, though. And I think hopefully – I think one of the things that our listeners have gained through listening to us over the last couple of years is some of that perspective, is some of that – you know, Francis and I are trying to get you to understand what it is from the other side.
We would have people come in to this little 50-seat restaurant and, you know, I'd be working the door and they'd say, oh, we'd like dinner for two. And I'd say, oh, you know, I'm terribly sorry. I'm booked up this evening. I don't have a table till 10 o'clock. And they'd say, we'll never be back again. And what am I supposed to apologize for being busy?
Yeah.
And believe me, it's breaking my heart. You, sir, have $100 in your pocket, and I would like it. Okay? I would love to serve you dinner, and I wish I could. And, you know, and eventually we were able to build more restaurants, and now we can accommodate the demand. But, you know, I was always amazed that people were offended by that because there's nothing we want to do more than to seat you. It's not like you're not wearing nice enough shoes to sit in the restaurant. It's I don't have enough seats.
Right. One of the things that people, I think, forget sometimes is we're in the accommodation business. I want to accommodate you. And whether there's some problem or something goes wrong during the course of your dinner, I want to accommodate you. So I'm always shocked when somebody feels like they're on the other side, like they're against me. You're never against me. I am always trying to accommodate you. And I think that's true in most good restaurants.
But sometimes you run up the brick wall against the brick wall if you don't have enough phones, you don't have enough space. And, well, I think it's an interesting problem that Table 52 has out there. I wish I had it myself. Oprah, mention me anytime. Stage left and Catherine Lombardi. And
I'll put a bunch of new phone lines in. I'll hire people. I'm ready.
Terrific. We're ready for it, Oprah. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Tracy Desjardins is our guest today. She is a chef on the West Coast where she has cooked, been a very important chef for many years. She's most recently on the Food Network's The Next Iron Chef, which we're going to talk to. But just to fill you in a little background, she has Jardiniere, which is her restaurant in San Francisco. She's also the managing chef at the Acme Chop House and Mojito, which is a more casual restaurant in San Francisco. In the spirit of full disclosure, I first had Tracy's food at a Rubicon restaurant in 1995, and I've been a fan ever since.
Tracy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You know, I want to reminisce for just a moment or two. We met about, I guess that's 12 years ago now. About 12 years ago.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah, exactly.
And it went like this. You came out and you said, hi. And I said, hi, your food's great. And you said, thank you very much.
That was it, huh?
It's changed my life, Tracy. Really.
Glad I could bestow those words of wisdom upon you.
And so endeth the romance.
But your food was wonderful, and we've, of course, followed you in the presses since then, and I've eaten your food when I've come out to San Francisco occasionally. You really broke through back in, oh, I guess, 94. There was a class that you sort of headed up of women chefs that were sort of breaking through what was considered a glass ceiling for a long time, and you sort of entered that realm of nationally important chef. I mean, did I get that right?
I think that's fairly accurate, yeah.
Now, what was it about you and some other women who came up around the same time as you that allowed you to break through that? Was it that the public was more receptive? Was it just, I mean, what ended that glass ceiling in the kitchen? I remember when I first started, a woman in the kitchen really faced a lot tougher time and a lot tougher tests from her peers and her chef.
Than she does now.
Well, and then the men would at that time. And I think that culture is sort of changing in all but a few holdouts, at least in the big cities. How did you bust through that, and what was your experience like doing that?
Well, I think it's more a matter of just the number of women that are in the business. I think that there are just a lot fewer of us, really, more than anything. I've been cooking for, God, almost 25 years now, and so, and certainly there were not a lot of women in the kitchen, particularly in France when I was there in the 80s. But, you know, I just think that there's a small handful of women that have gone out there and really been competitive in what is, I think, still, you know, fairly dominated, you know, field by men, but have gone out and worked in the best restaurants and really gotten the experience that allows them to be in the upper echelons of food. So I think it's more, you know, a matter of that than anything.
Yeah, I as well first had your food at Rubicon back in the mid-90s there, and Larry Stone was the sommelier.
The fabulous Larry Stone.
And actually, yeah. There was a guy who was maitre d' at the time by the name of Michael Carlucci, who's a friend of Francis.
Absolutely.
And
Carlucci, I've known him since the 80s in New York.
Yeah. And, yeah. You know, but that was a big step for a female chef to take on one of Drew Neaport's restaurants and to suddenly be thrust into the media, because you were thrust into the media.
And to kick some royal butt, I might add.
Yeah, thank you very much. But, you know, I mean, I worked for Deborah Ponczak in the 80s at Montrachet in New York. Mm-hmm. She was the chef there when I was there. So, you know, there have always been women around. It's just, like I said, I think that there just aren't as many of us. And so it's, you know, by the sheer percentages, you see less that are sort of in the forefront of the world of cooking.
Well, now let's go off the gender issue for a second. Now, you're working at Rubicon, where you have you're having great success, and you do what, you know, so many great chefs do. You take that step to open your own place, and you open Jardiniere. Why open your own place, and what's the vision that you have for Jardiniere? Because you've done other restaurants with different ideas behind them since, but talk to us about Jardiniere and what you're still doing there all these years later.
Well, Jardiniere was a partnership between myself and Pat Coletto, and Pat had made this, you know, incredible restaurant boulevard with Nancy Oakes. So he had a history of you know, working with a great woman chef and giving her the forum to really do her own food and be in the national spotlight. And Boulevard is just one of the great success stories of the San Francisco dining.
Another really great restaurant.
Yeah, and it's, you know, been number one Zagat for years and years, and is just a really incredible restaurant. And Nancy's a great chef. So, you know, it was sort of natural when Pat approached me, and I was very happy at Rubicon. Loved working with Larry Stone. Loved working with Drew Neaport. But I had always wanted to have my own restaurant, and so this was the golden opportunity to do so with someone who was very experienced and obviously supportive of women in the industry, so it was just a natural. And it was also a great space. I used to drive by the space that's now Jardiniere, and it was empty for about 3 years, and it was very compelling to me. And, I mean, as you guys know, it's kind of, the restaurant business to some extent is there's a gut instinct involved in the space that you choose and location and...
It's kind of like hearing voices.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And
which,
you know,
is a clinical diagnosis, if you want to know the truth.
Right, exactly. So, you know, the space really spoke to me, and I thought it was a great location for a lot of reasons. It was sort of a transitional neighborhood, but it was right next to the Symphony and Opera. And I thought, well, God, what a great opportunity. I mean, you've got this built-in business that's going to happen at 5:30. And then, you know, the rest of the time is, you know, that was sort of the icing, if you will. And then the primetime dining was the cake. And it just made business sense. And the space and location spoke to me. And partnership with Pat seemed like it was going to work well. And it wasn't a matter of my wanting to leave Drew and Larry by any means. I absolutely adore them both and love working with them. But it was an opportunity for me to own my own business.
You know, Francis and I had a similar experience. We opened next to three theaters in downtown New Brunswick. And one of the things that we learned with that built-in business is getting slaughtered between 5:30 and 8 o'clock and realizing that 8 o'clock is really a deadline when somebody needs to go, when someone's going to a show.
Yeah, it's a wild ride. I think that at Jardiniere we produce very fine, refined food at an incredibly high volume. And my old chef who's since left me, but said, you know, it's 4-star food at 4 million miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that is indeed what it is.
When we come back, we're going to talk more with Tracy Desjardins, who's been a very influential chef on the West Coast and throughout the country. 1450 WCTC, the time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick. And its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. Our guest is Tracy Desjardins. She was most recently on The Next Iron Chef, currently airing on the television. But we're talking about her restaurants in California. Jardiniere is your flagship restaurant out there, and it's right next to the Symphony. One of the things we found that's so interesting about being, we're next to three theaters in New Brunswick. Our restaurant, our first restaurant is called Stage Left, for that very reason. And you know, it's a grueling thing. It's a lot of pressure when you have a pre-theater restaurant. Because what we tell the staff is, listen, we need to be elegant, we need to be gracious,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, at 8 o'clock these people are leaving.
No matter what.
Whether they've had dessert or not, you know what I mean? If their entrees are not, they're going. So that hard deadline is different.
Yeah, talk to us about the expectations of the diners in your dining room and how they might be different from one table to the next.
Well, we have a lot of people that are destination dining, but then, you know, the majority of the folks in that theater turn are going to the theater. And so what I'm constantly drilling into my staff is that, you know, they're conscious of that, but they're not going to take responsibility for it. So we have to manage the tables. If people are coming in and they're relaxed and they're taking it easy, you know, we always have that timeline in our brains. And we have different curtain times also, sometimes it's 7, 7:38. And so my service staff really has to be managers of their tables and really aware of exactly what the needs are of that table. And so we're speaking to lots of different needs, and we also have to discern whether people are there or not. I mean, they just happen to come in early, but they're not going to the theater and slow things down. So my service staff has to be really on top of what the exact needs are of every table and really manage that because that's our job.
Yeah, one of the things to the customers is that we know exactly how long everything takes.
Right.
So we're trying to get you into a place so that each of those things can happen in a timely fashion.
Well, and, you know, sometimes people will, and this is not a shot on anybody, but if you don't manage the table, somebody will walk in at 6:15 for their 8 o'clock theater, but, you know, chat and not order until 7:15. And
right.
Then at 7:25, they'll say, where's my food? I've got to go to the theater.
I've been here for an hour.
I mean, you just gave me your order 5 minutes ago.
Right. Yeah, and we have to, you know, we're the ones that have to take responsibility for that because they're just going to be mad. They're going to feel like we didn't, you know, fulfill our deal with them and taking care of them.
I tell my staff, somebody will be less upset at you for rushing them for 5 minutes in the beginning of the meal than they will be for rushing you 5 minutes before they go to the theater.
Absolutely.
Hey, listen, we're going to come back after the news and talk more with Tracy Desjardins about her restaurants, about cuisine in California and America. We're also going to talk about the Food Network's The Next Iron Chef, on which she most recently appeared. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left at Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we have with us a very important chef. Tracy Desjardins has had Jardiniere in San Francisco. She's the managing chef at Acme Chop House. And she also has Mojita restaurant out there. She's one of the most written about and influential chefs in the country. She was most recently on the Food Network's The Next Iron Chef. And Tracy, let's talk about that a little bit. The Next Iron Chef, if you haven't listened, if you're under a rock somewhere, is not Top Chef. That's a different show where they bring in sort of relative culinary, you know, amateurs or roundsmen or, you know, journeymen to come together to compete to be an executive chef. Iron Chef are some of the top chefs in the country. And they were looking to mix it up and add a new regular member to the Iron Chef ranks. And so the show The Next Iron Chef brought some top chefs from across the country, among which we had Tracy Desjardins, to compete to join that show's regular cast.
So what we're going to have here in a weekly segment, the person who gets voted off the show is going to come on with us and talk to us a little bit about what they're doing with their careers, but also their experience on the show. And that's one of the reasons Tracy's here today.
So, Tracy, you're off the show. Disappointing.
Yes.
But, you know, this isn't like you're a journeyman chef and this was your break into the big time. You're in the big time. But talk to us about why you decided to participate in the show and what the show means, you know, for those who participate at all and what you think it means to become an Iron Chef. And where does this fall into the whole culinary universe? I'm not quite sure myself.
Well, I mean, you know, the show, the Iron Chef America is a great show. And I was on 2 years ago and went on and had a really great time.
Well, you had a really great time because you beat Mario Batali.
That's right, yeah, my buddy Mario.
It's better when you win, isn't it?
It is better when you win. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, I had a great time on the show. It's a fantastic show. It's, you know, a great forum for, you know, what we do, you know, a certain part of what we do. It was just a fantastic experience. And I sort of have, you know, a very adventuresome spirit. I mean, who in the restaurant business doesn't really? You got to be willing to take risks. You know, it's an everyday part of the restaurant business, highly risky business. And so I think that, you know, a lot of chefs are sort of inclined towards that kind of adventure, if you will, and myself certainly being one of them. And so it was a natural when the Food Network contacted me to want to go and do this kind of thing. You know, I had a definite feeling that they didn't tell us ahead of time who else was going to be on the show. But it was obvious that they were going to pick some of the top people in the country, and it wasn't going to be an amateur show. So it was a great opportunity to go on and compete against people who have been successful in their own careers and wanted to take a step onto television.
Well, I'll tell you what, Tracy, Francis and I have to ante up again because we both had you in the office pool.
Well, thank you. I think you were in good company from what I sort of hear out there.
What he's telling you is that you owe us $20.
Yeah, okay, all right.
Well, you know, what's funny, though, is because we have the Top Chef guys come on the show, too. I love that show as well. I think Colicchio is great. I love Colicchio, and I like what they do there. But that's a lot more about, like, drama. It's a little bit like the MTV House Where the Kids Live is part of what goes on there. This is about cooking pure and simple, but I think it's also about, you know, this, I don't want to say it, but this doesn't really, if you're, you know, the sous chef at Guy Savoy in Las Vegas, and then you
right.
become America's Top Chef, the character of your career has just changed.
Right.
Right.
Even if you became Iron Chef, the next Iron Chef, I don't think it really changes the character of your career. I mean, it's not like the Iron Chef, you know, there are Michelin 3-star chefs that aren't Iron Chefs. You know
right,
what I mean?
Absolutely.
It's not like that's not the ultimate validation of you've made it to the next level.
Right.
But you know, I think people need to look at this as an interesting contest between great culinary minds. But it is just one day. You know, the thing about all of the contestants who are vying for the position of next Iron Chef is that you guys run restaurants every day, and you have established – you're a James Beard Award-winning chef, for heaven's sake.
Two of them, by the way.
And it's time to talk about that as well. No,
you're two chefs?
No, two James Beard Awards.
Oh, okay.
Well, but that and also, you know, we were talking before the show began, you know, we should tell the audience and over the course of the news – you know, about owning a restaurant and running a restaurant every day. You know, that's something entirely different from competing on a show. You know, I feel like I'm in a contest every month when as long as I make the mortgage payment, I've won.
Right, exactly, absolutely.
You know, now you have three restaurants, though. Talk to us about the differences in the three restaurants. They seem to be as different as they could possibly be. Talk to us about Acme Chop House.
Yeah, Acme Chop House was a great opportunity for me to work with a pretty, you know, big food service company. It was also a great forum in that, I mean, starting there, you know, it's definitely a fine dining restaurant. It's a destination for foodies. It's expensive. You know, it's all of those things that are sort of a small section of society, I think, that goes to those kind of restaurants. Whereas Acme Chop House is located at the AT&T Park in San Francisco, and it's kind of an everyman's restaurant. You know, you've got this great cross-section of people that go to the ballpark, and it was a forum for me to widen the audience and to do something a little bit different to, you know, for the larger cross-section of society. And it was really appealing for me in that sense. You know, people come in for burgers and beers, and they're going to the baseball game, and it's just really fun, and it's very casual, and I think it's very reflective of how I cook at home, you know, not fancy food. Just, you know, I love to grill, and we've got a big, you know, wood-burning grill there and rotisserie, and it's just a different expression, I think, of myself and more akin to, you know, the hospitality at home and food that you'd make for your family.
Well, plus you're a Giants fan.
I'm a Giants fan, you bet. In the first year that we took over the restaurant, we went to the World Series, so that was pretty exciting.
And do you attribute their success in the field to that restaurant having opened right next to the...
Yeah, that year, the World Series year. I was the lucky charm, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Clearly it's about grass-fed,
you know,
steak.
I have a question to ask you. Now, you run three restaurants. We run two restaurants, one fine dining and expensive, and we think, you know, at the top of the field of American contemporary fine dining in our state. And we run Catherine Lombardi, which is based on Mark's family's cuisine, Italian-American cuisine. Is it, in your opinion, easier to run that your casual burger place than it is to run Acme Chop House? Is that easier to run than Chardonnier?
No, it's not easier. I mean, you know, restaurants, each of them have their own particular set of, you know, challenges. You know, we do incredibly high volume at Acme. It's not unlike Chardonnier in that it's, you know, there's a deadline for that baseball game. So that was actually one of the reasons why I wanted to go into that space as well, because I felt like I had some expertise in that you know, arena of making sure that you're getting 250 people fed when they've got some place to go.
You know, I always remember a place I used to go down at the in Jersey. We say down the shore. Maybe you've heard a Bruce Springsteen song where he said
right.
that. We go down the shore, and we would go down the shore, and there was this bar I went to when I was like 19 years old, and it was owned by an old guy. And the bar opened sort of when he got there, you know, and then you went in, and if you ordered a Bloody Mary, he would make you the best Bloody Mary. It took him 15 minutes, but he made you the best Bloody Mary you could possibly make. You ordered a screwdriver, he squeezed the orange juice fresh, and if you didn't like the way he made it, get out.
he asked you to leave.
And if it took too long, well, you can just leave.
Yeah.
And it's funny because this guy had obviously had made his money and was just, he wanted to run this bar. It's a very different thing when you really are in that sort of high gear hospitality, whether it's for, you know, searing foie gras in the kitchen or serving burgers on the grill.
Yeah.
You know, making that number of people happy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, you know, the other restaurant is Mexican. You know, we're in the Ferry Building, which has an incredible amount of traffic during lunchtime. And so, again, you know, we're really serving quite a few people in a short period of time, you know, the crunch period. It's, you know, it's a very simple menu. It's, you know, tacos from Mexico. It's sort of, you know, kind of street food, finger food kind of thing. It has its set of challenges as well. Namely that it's a fairly low revenue base in terms of our gross, and it's not a lot of staff. I have one manager there basically, and it has its set of challenges as well. So each one has a sort of unique, place in the world of restaurants and different sets of issues.
But none of it's really easy.
The restaurant business isn't easy. Didn't anyone tell you that?
Yeah,
yes.
No, they didn't. They didn't actually. Now, I don't know if I didn't believe them or I was younger.
People,
I don't know.
People told me, I just ignored them.
Yeah.
Tracy, when we come back, can we talk a little bit more about Next Iron Chef?
You bet.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:45.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work. Until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. We're talking with Tracy Desjardins, owner of Jardiniere in San Francisco, Acme Chop House, Mojita, and most recently on The Next Iron Chef. You know, Tracy, let's talk about an award that you won that I love that you won. I think it's great. You won the Golden Dumpster Award.
The Golden Dumpster Award, my favorite. I love to talk about trash.
So let's talk about the Golden. You wouldn't think that a restaurateur would be happy with such a thing like that, but it's a pretty prestigious award. Tell us about the Golden Dumpster Award.
Well, we were one of the pioneers in the Bay Area of recycling. Fortunately, we have an incredible support from the city and the trash folks out here, and we were able to basically take a look at our environmental footprint and change the way that looked. I mean, restaurants obviously generate a lot of waste, and we were able to really minimize that so that we were taking what was once 100% landfill and making it so that 90% of that became recyclable or compostable materials, and only 10% of that was going into the landfill. So it's pretty incredible. And, you start to think about that in the scope of the world. I mean, if we could all do that, boy, we wouldn't have a lot of the problems that we have. And so I'm very proud of that award. I think we've really changed the way that restaurants deal with their refuse in the Bay Area. I mean, it's been a concerted effort by lots of different restaurateurs, but it's pretty amazing, and boy, would I love to see, New York City do that, because it's, you look at, mountains and mountains of trash, and you think about, the fact that really 90% of that can be used for something else. It's kind of inspiring.
It's
trash.
Yeah, my dad had a farm in upstate New York when I was a kid, and we composted up there, and I think that people would be amazed at how much of your garbage can actually become compost.
Well, we have this, incredible program that's now in residences that started in restaurants in the Bay Area. But we have green bins in San Francisco, and you can basically put, in the way that I try to frame it for people so they can understand it, anything that was ever alive can go into this green bin and gets turned into compost.
Or even going to be alive, like an eggshell.
Like an eggshell, right, exactly. Yes, thank you.
Well, now talk to us about, that's a pretty big statistic. You took 90% of the restaurant's garbage and turned it into something that doesn't go into landfill. How do you manage, or how would, say, someone in New York City where, there's not a field where you can put your compost pile, how do you manage that?
Well, I think that, the approach has to be to really city governments so that they already have the resources to transport this stuff, right? So if it's a matter of just getting, the folks to separate it all, and then it's going to 3 different places. So you've got your bottles and cans and paper. You have your garbage that, goes to landfill that nothing can be done with. And then you've got all your compostables. And they're already transporting this stuff. So in San Francisco, basically what they did was they just, changed the facilities around a little bit, used the same trucks, and got everybody to separate their stuff so that everything's being used again.
So does the compostable stuff have to be stored in? I mean, one of the things that I find most appealing about, I have some friends, we have a lot of friends who have similar views on the environment that as to us. And, you know, if you have a suburban home and you're waiting for your garbage, the compost, what you can compost is the stuff that is most likely to smell in your garbage can and whatever. And if you take it out of your compost heap instead, you know, there's no waiting for the garbage man. There's no leaving it around for rodents to get it. But how in a city does San Francisco get that compostable material? Like, what do I do when I put it out in my backyard? Do I put it not? You can't put it in a plastic bag.
Well, that's the thing that you have to, you know, that you realize once you start doing it. It's really when you deprive these materials of air that they begin to stink. So we have plastic bins and then a regular dumpster that all of our wet waste goes into, but we don't bag any of it. And, you know, initially when they sort of presented us with this process, we thought, oh, my God, this is going to be horrible. It's going to stink to high heaven. But it actually stinks less than garbage that you have in bags. So it's like once you put garbage in contact with the plastic bags and you deprive it of air, that's when it starts to stink. If you just throw it all in a bin and it's not enclosed in plastic, it doesn't smell.
And they just pick up the bin, take the bin, dump it out, and then they clean it and bring it back to you?
Yeah. And, I mean, you know, I do this at home, too. Okay, so in the restaurant, they pick it up every day. But at home, they don't pick it up every day. They pick it up once a week. But still, if you're not bagging it or you're using those bio bags that actually degrade, which makes it a little bit neater, the stuff just doesn't stink.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. All right, well, we're going to come back in just a moment and not talk about garbage.
Okay.
We're food. We'll be back in just a moment with Tracy Desjardins. 1450 WCTC time is 11:53. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking and having a wonderful time with Tracy Desjardins, owner of Jardiniere Acme Chop House, managing chef and Mojita out in California, and most recently on The Next Iron Chef.
So, Tracy, we watched The Next Iron Chef, and you do get eliminated in the first episode, which was heartbreaking for us.
Well, thank you.
But I have to ask the question. Why did you choose? Now Tracy has to make a dessert, and you're making a dessert with kind of atypical dessert ingredients.
Right.
And I have to ask, why, when you had things like bacon and beef fallow in front of you, did you choose salmon roe?
I guess that was my fatal mistake. You know, we chose in sequence, so I think I was the fifth one to choose. I think that's correct.
Thereabouts. You were in the middle somewhere.
And so I think remaining were beef shoulder, which scared me for some reason, just because I sort of think that, you know, you need to braise that for a long time, and that wasn't going to happen in 90 minutes. I think the other remaining thing was maybe squid, which seemed equally dubious as salmon roe, although Gavin seemed to handle it quite deftly. And I can't remember what the other one was. It might have been, it wasn't tripe. Tripe was the one that I think had us all quaking except for Chris.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it was, you know, it was quick. So you didn't really have time to think it through. I guess if I had to do it all over again, I might not have chosen salmon roe. Maybe the beef would have been a safer one because, you know, salmon roe is pretty pungent.
The shakes are scary, man.
But tripe, I think that in my mind I was just happy not to have tripe.
Yeah, I hear you. That would have been the scariest one for me. But he, you know, Chris Cosentino is the Chris that you're talking about who actually worked for you way back when.
Yes, he did, yeah.
And he chose tripe and made a dish that they didn't hate out of
right.
tripe.
I think he kind of took one for the team there, you know.
What did he do with it?
He braised it. Well, he stuck it in the pressure cooker, which I think he had done tripe when he was on Iron Chef. And so, you know, we all do a lot of research before we go on cooking stuff in a pressure cooker. So he really had the cooking time and all that down very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he braised it in some fruit juices so it was nice and tender. And then he deep fried it, excuse me, and made a sort of a panzanella salad or, you know, sweet panzanella out of it. So it was very clever, you know, he did a great job. And, you know, like I said, he took one for the team, which was great.
I got to tell you, when he picked tripe, I got to say, tripe and fish eggs, I thought, were the two ones that I would have tried to stay away from.
Uh-huh.
And when he picked tripe, I'm like, you're going third, man. Don't pick the tripe.
Exactly.
What are you doing?
I don't know why. I mean, the beef shoulder was the one that kind of loomed for me. And, I mean, obviously the tripe, but, you know, I was very happy when Chris picked that. I don't know why I picked the salmon eggs. I guess it was a bad move.
Yeah, for me, I guess my immediate thoughts were, you know, the bacon pork fat you can do something with, and the same thing with the beef. Even with the beef fat, though, you could render that off and do something with the beef fat that would be, you know, pastry-ish.
Right. Yeah. But it was a pretty tight-looking shoulder, though. It didn't have a lot of fat around it. I guess if it had had, you know, a ton of fat around it, I would have maybe been more inclined towards that. But
you would have worked that angle.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because Jill picked, well, she didn't get to pick. She ended up with that beef shoulder last. So it seemed like maybe it was the one that we were almost wary of.
Yeah, I just can't believe that anybody, that the tripe wasn't the last thing. That show. Scare the tar out of me. You know, frankly, for me to cook tripe on a savory dish would scare the tar out of me.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
Hey, Tracy, I want to thank you for coming on the show with us. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Tracy,
well,
you've been great.
Thank you very much.
That's Tracy Desjardins, ladies and gentlemen. You can find out more about her on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. If you're going to be out on the West Coast, you have to go to Jardinière. You haven't been to San Francisco if you haven't been to Jardinière. I hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascoe.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.